Okay, so today's discussion is on instabilities and localization, leading to localization, and our agenda will get us started.
Did you want to say anything about this?
I just put this up, so, because I thought it sort of motivated the connection between theory of shear bands, or whatever we're going to listen to, and earthquakes. So Bruce Hawes is probably one of the best-known structural geologists on the planet. And he set forth this quite a long time ago, as you can see, 17 years ago. And there's a following literature associating various structures that are seen from erosion faults and these kinds of instabilities. So I can show some showing cross-sections, showing the structures that fall in the acid dip. But that just, I thought, gave a chance to motivate us.
Well, I'm going to talk about shear band metals and polymers, and very briefly in metallic classes, and then go through basic plasticity theory to show what one can do by calculating these things. So let me turn this off. I want to start with a short quotation from Horowan. When you do a tensile test, you take a piece of something and pull on it, you close your eyes to it and just record the load elongation value, and you get something, and you actually don't have any idea of what happened to this material or the dip is. And that's the dilemma that he's talking about. But there are so many things that go on unless you focus attention on those, not anything on what physical processes occur. Actually a longer version of that quote, which is very colorful. So we'll look at mechanisms of what happens to the deformation as you apply tension on the material. So it's an alpha iron or low alloy steels. It looks like they would shape them in alloys. The class of polymers exemplified by polycarbonate, perhaps by polystyrene as well, that be formed by shear yielding as opposed to the other class that forms from cavitation and void growth. So PMMA and things like that are out of the realm of this class. And then some metallic classes, these are farms I just dug up in the last couple of days just to complete the story. I have not included any examples from granular materials and rocks. They do undergo the kind of shear instabilities that we'll talk about, particularly the granular materials. Rocks exhibit some slightly different degrees of compaction or densification or localization. And they also do the same kind of propagation that we'll talk about here, but I will not say anything about these two classes of materials. I'm basically going to walk you through each one of the materials, show what happens in the tensile test microscopically and to the material microscopically. So the generic experiment is you get a dowel shaped material. Typically they are actually flat sheets. Grip them on the ends and pull the machine at constant strain rate. Monitor the force and the elongation, and you typically get something like that for an alpha iron, for example.
Can you tell us what the scale is?
Yeah, this is stress and this is strain. So this is force normalized by the cross-sectional area.
Epsilon, there's no real units.
That distance is about 4 times 10 to the minus 4. They're extremely small strains.
Okay.
So yielding and localization in this material occurs at very low strain levels. You don't get to 2% strain, for instance. These little shifted curve, all stress strain curves, loaded up to a very low stress level and unloaded, perfectly reversible. There's no accumulated damage or dissipation in this particular scheme. Continue to increase the maximum load. At some point, you start accumulating inelastic deformation inside and there's dissipation. So the area under that curve will be the dissipated plastic work in the material.
Do those go back to where they start from, or is there an offset on the axis?
It's a very, very small offset, as you can see here. There is an offset, but it's a very small one.
not so much as up above.
Correct.
They're not parallel paths.
Correct. But if you go up to this level, it's called the upper yield point, something drastic happens. At this point, there's an instability. Deformation localizes in some region within the length of the specimen, and then the load drops as a result of that. Further on, you don't really have a uniform specimen deforming, but you have something that has a localized feature. Something happens to a localized feature. We'll walk you through what happens there. This onset corresponds to the initiation of a band. I should bring the next picture here. A band that's oriented at some angle to the loading axis. And initially, it's not everywhere. It's just a very sharp band somewhere in the interior. It's uniformly deformed here, uniformly deformed below. And in that band, it's experienced a very large shear deformation, and that's the localization.
Ravi, I've heard it claims that these things always nucleate from corners.
Anywhere. If you do a very careful experiment, you can nucleate it in the interior. You can trigger it in the interior by putting in a flaw. This is not a material property.
Right.
This is influenced by the defect concentration within the material, where the banding, the shear localization is going to nucleate. Or it can occur at regions of stress concentration, where the local stress is far above the mean stress that you have.
Which typically happens
at the ends. The stress concentrations happen at the end, so if you have a fairly uniform distribution of defect population here, the stress concentration will be the one that triggers localization. If you put a little nick somewhere here, that defect will lower locally the nucleation threshold, and so it will localize there. So there are experiments where you see nucleation pretty much anywhere. There is another way in which you can nucleate it within this segment, that's by dynamic loading, and if we have time, I'll say something about that towards the very end. Then you may be able to distribute a uniform stress increasing everywhere at the same rate, and you'll have multiple nucleation sites. But once the band nucleates, there's a very large shear strain that appears along the band, and so the entire specimen unloads to a lower stress level, if we're driving this with a constant rate of cross-set motion. So there's no further nucleation of bands at all, and during this plateau region, all that happens is the nucleated band slowly migrates up, consumes the entire length of the specimen. And then strain hardening effects take over. If you continue this, it will sort of go on like that until global failure of the specimen occurs. So this is not a failure at this point. That little drop there is simply the result of localizing the deformation at some point within the age length of the specimen.
The fact that the band broadens as a function of the overall strain is indicative of having some
stabilizing
fixed amount of, some fixed amount of strain within the band.
Correct.
And
that is this segment here. There's a certain amount of slip, and after that, you're not able to propagate that shearing motion because dislocations are pinned. You go to the next slide and say, the initial part is elastic deformation of the lattice. The point at which this localization occurs is where dislocations that are pinned at solute atoms anywhere on the specimen get released, and so dislocations are able to move very quickly. That's the instability of the process. And once those things start to move, they get pinned at other dislocations that are oriented in the other direction, the forest dislocations, or at other impurities or at grain boundaries. This is sort of the strain hardening effect. So there's a small amount of strain through which these dislocations can slip. Typically 3% in these low alloy steels. And then they're no longer able to move. So they strain harden. So the band has no way of continuing to accommodate shear on there and simply breaking off. But instead, it recruits new material into it and keeps moving on in that direction. Now, if you think of materials that don't string harden very much, take pure copper, and you do the same experiment, once the shear band forms at that point, there is no further possibility for this shear band to propagate up. It will simply shear along here until it gets broken into two pieces at the point of localization. So it's essential to have this mechanism of strain hardening in order to limit the strain that comes in the instability region in the shear band, and then for that shear band to propagate up along the length of the specimen. That's going to be a characteristic of all of the materials I'm going to talk about. There's a limit in the amount of strain you can accumulate through that shear instability. This is typically called Luter strain. It's about 3% here. The next example is polycarbonate. It's about 70%.
Is there a finite thickness, or is that just some apparent imaging effect on the?
I was going to get to that at the very end. There is a low end where you cannot resolve these bands. They're typically on the order of the grain size, so the thickness of the band. But if you change the grain size, the band sort of becomes diffuse. So there is a definite effect of the underlying microstructure and what the band thickness can be. This is an imaging artifact. These things are not the size of the bands. In other words, the band doesn't move in increments of that.
What according to estimation characteristic time of the formation of single shear bands and characteristic lengths?
The length is on the order of grain size.
And it's grain size, yes.
Right. So
and the characteristic time or strain rate inside of shear bands?
The strain rates can be extremely high because you're accumulating about 3% strain. But it can be on a time scale that varies from microseconds to milliseconds, depending on how fast you pull it. So 10 to the 3, 10 to the 6.
10 to the 6, 10 to the 7,
right.
Like that.
Right.
Okay. Where does the contrast of the micro-hat come from?
It's a tinting effect. These steels, when they are made, get a blue tint because of the heat treatment. There's an oxide layer that forms on the surface, which is brittle. And when you jump that through a 3% strain, the brittle layer doesn't adhere to the substrate, it flakes off. So you could use that as a way of tracking where the strain has gone through the Luter strain and where it hasn't. Yeah?
The orientation of the shear band, 54 degrees, is material deformed?
I will get to the angle also quantitatively later on. It's not material dependent. It depends on the geometry of what you do to the specimen. There are, the next example I'm going to show is polycarbonate. It comes out at exactly the same angle. And you can make this one go to 45 degrees if you do a plane strain test. This isn't a thin sheet, which is closer to a plane stress stick. If you change it to a very thick bar in here, it will go off to 45. That'll be the plane of maximum shear stress. All right, the next one is polycarbonate. Same geometry, you take a rod of this thing, a rectangular cross section, and pull on it. Initially, it exhibits an elastic response. There's some amount of nonlinearity, which could be viscoelastic. You could consider that to be plastic deformation if you want. At some point, it reaches a limit load. Something localizes, the load drops as a result of that. And then there's a plateau stress for a very, very long stretch. So the specimen is stretched to about 1.6 times its initial length at constant load, and then the load starts to pick up again.
The initiating stress strain here now,
yeah,
is very different.
Correct. This is on the order of 6% or so. Because these are softer materials, the stiffness is two orders of magnitude lower than the steel. They can accommodate a large strain fairly easily. Now,
that's also, I think, sample dependent. I've seen polycarbonate data where it's more like 2%, and that may be because of this bit of
fillers and things like that. Yeah,
any sort of
Any additives, right. And this is a common experience. I think every one of you has done this thing. You take saran wrap and you stretch it. So you first make it straight and then start applying a force, an increasing force. At some point, you see the thing becomes more compliant if you can stretch it to many times its length. So you're going through the same transition. At that point, you do something to the structure of the polymer, which enables it to undergo large strains fairly rapidly, easily. If I focus on just that, this part, the first 10% strain or so, along the path, I unloaded it to see what kind of hysteretic effects you have. So there is a lot of dissipation or inelasticity that's probably viscoelastic. But there is the limit load at which the localization occurs. If you take a look at the structure of the polymer.
Why is it, this is a general sort of, when you say visco, why do you think it's visco?
Because if I bring this all the way back down here, and I sit for 2 days, or I elevate the temperature, it comes back to here. So it's an elastic deformation with the viscous component, and the viscosity will bring it back. The locked-in elastic energy will bring the thing back to its initial shape. But so there's no permanent deformation there.
But for now, if you talk about viscous fluid, there'll be a permanent deformation.
If you just leave it there.
Well, if you take off the stress.
If you bring it down here.
Fluid,
right.
If you take off the stress, it depends which of the two viscous realities, viscoelastic realities you're talking about, parallel or in series.
Well, I have both. I have a short-term elasticity and a long-term elasticity in this material. So if I just leave it there, it will shrink back to its original shape.
By what kind of thermally activated mechanism?
No, because if you've done a loading and you stretch the polymer bonds a little bit and you let go of that, that energy will bring it back until the stress in those chains goes off to zero.
Yeah, but I guess it may be that that motion is extremely slow.
Correct. And you can help it
thermally.
Yeah.
Activated.
Correct. That's what I said. You can help it thermally by heating it up and it will retract to its initial state.
So
yeah.
Since you see it up to a certain strain, right?
Correct.
Yes.
Yeah, up until you go over that hump. Okay. Now, if you go over that hump, you've changed everything structurally and you will never recover it.
According to my knowledge, there is also quite different nature in plateau and strain localization for metals, for polymer materials, because in metals it's just orientation effects and not some dislocations. In polymeric materials, it's orientation effects and ensemble of molecular systems.
Well, what I'm showing is that the underlying mechanism of deformation is quite different.
It's quite different.
But macroscopically, they exhibit similarities, and I'm going to show you what that similarity is. Right? So if I look at what happens in the material at some level below the peak load, see a distribution of these cross-shaped features. They're actually micro shear bands. Their localization is on the scale of, that's in the order of 100 microns or so. So if they're micron-sized features, needle-like or plated-like features that are distributed everywhere, more or less uniformly along the length of the specimen. You could look for it anywhere. There's a preference or collection near the free surface because of defects that are already in there from the machining process. If you go over to that plateau, some of these things link up and they form a macroscopic shear band like that. Very similar to, macroscopically very similar to the Lewis band in the metal. And as you move down beyond this, now these strain levels are very large, so the Luder strain that's in that band is extremely large. So that band continues to slide off, but it pulls the chains and it orients all of the molecules along here. So the Luder's band is no longer recognizable in the same form as it was in the metal. The metal only had 3% strain, here it has 70% strain or so. So that is the Luder's band. So you have material that's unsheared or unoriented out there and unoriented down here. So
everywhere inside here, it's gone through this lunar strain, and therefore it's been stretched to its full molecular stretch capability. That's where the limit comes from. These molecules, when you entangle them, they can stretch to about 1.7, and then you start pulling on the backbone molecules, it becomes extremely stiff, and that's when you reach this portion. So the limit to the accumulation of strain here is the molecular stretch that you can have from the coiled molecule to the fully stretched molecule.
Well, fully stretched between entanglements.
Between entanglements. Well, some of the entanglements have broken. Probably a large number of entanglements have broken.
I don't think you need to break that many to get up to 1.6. But this is, do you have any, this is highly entangled polycarbonate.
Correct. And the orientation of the band is exactly the same as the orientation of the other one, because there's also thin platelet specimens under plane stress.
That's measured at that initial?
Yes, it's measured at this point, because there isn't any sense
in measuring. Look in the microband, shouldn't it be?
That's a good point. It's exactly the same, because at the microstructural scale, there is no texture here. There is nothing that can dictate other than the global stress field, so the angles are exactly the same. In contrast, if you look at the polycrystalline metallic materials, and you go in and look at where these slip events have occurred, where the dislocations have moved, they're completely controlled by the slip planes and their orientation, which are random with respect to the macroscopic thing. So microscopically, this is extremely different from the steels, but you still see overall this band. Yeah.
I want to ask you a question about the critical degree, because I thought that in the theory for that,
right? Yeah.
And I thought that in the theory that we have to have volume conservation.
Right.
And so I was wondering if there are levels where it does not happen, where we don't have volume conservation.
In this case?
No, in other materials. I was wondering if there are materials where there is no volume conservation and where.
In materials that are dilatant. For instance, in compaction bands for crushing materials or for granular materials, the band orientation will alter because you have a pressure dependence or dilatancy dependence or shear stress. So it won't be 54, but you can calculate the corresponding characteristics. They're going to vary slightly depending on the friction coefficient.
When you talk about generate materials, quasi materials and stuff like that, it's usually.
Yeah, it's usually this one, 54 if it is plane stress and 45 if it is plane strain.
Robin, these things aren't mobile, right? The bands thickened by nucleation between, you have a kind of an increased nucleation between different shear bands?
No.
They're not going to move once they're formed. Right?
No, once they're formed, what happens is, as you continue to stretch, this is the weak point, and so it's continuing to pull the chains until they orient themselves. But once you get to full stretch on this, this is stiff. And therefore, the only option is for this feature here, now they call it a neck, to move up and down, recruiting new material. So it's propagating again in the same way the Luders band did in the steel, but it's now a different geometry because of the very large strains that are involved here.
And these are cross-linked, correct?
No, these are not. Typically, a cross-linked polymer will not do this. It fractures rather than pulls out these strains, these molecules, and all reorients.
I'm sorry, you mentioned it, but I couldn't find it. What the geometry of this? Is this a plate or a bar?
It's a thin.
It's a plate oriented.
Correct.
Way.
Yeah, okay. In this direction, so it's very small thickness.
So, if you were to look at the plate in the other direction, are there bands forming?
It's just this one. It's a thinning in that direction.
But this microscopic picture.
You don't see those. That's correct, because they're all oriented in this plane.
They're oriented in that.
Correct. Right. So the initial deformation is elastic stretching of the weak bonds, and then you sort of start breaking the entanglements, or at high stress levels, you can even start the viscous flow, because the free volume increases at those high stress levels. So it's one of these that starts and leads to the micro shear banding. There are some theories that say the free volume defects actually act as the nuclei for these kind of things that occur, not necessarily the entanglements that break, but free volume defects can also concentrate stress around there.
I'm really confused by your statement about breaking of entanglements.
Okay.
There is no need for the entanglements to break, and no evidence that I've seen that they break until the strains get to much larger than this. In fact, up to the sort of 6 to 8% strains we're talking about here, chains don't even know whether they're entangled, because you can look at the polycarbonate unentangled or entangled and see the same result up to strains of order this typical peak value.
Well,
once you get local yielding and strain occurring, you begin to stretch the segments between entanglements, which naively can be thought of as being like crosslinks.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's what gives you your strain hardening at these large engineering strains of 1.6.
Okay.
But you shouldn't need to break any entanglements in this initial
phase. The only reason I say that is there are experiments where people have arbitrarily done crosslinks by irradiation.
Mm-hmm.
And they can move this level back and forth by just doing that. And so attribute this to some, so there the idea is in order to get to that localization to release large strains, you have to break the crosslinks that you've made.
Yes.
Parallel to this material is then entanglements.
But this particular peak position is strongly dependent on defects. And so any heterogeneity in the crosslinking also will move that to lower strain for entirely different reasons. And it also affects the macroscopic, you know, the shear hardening limit, and therefore the point where, you know, the maximum strain inside your shear band. So
there are two parallel arguments here, and there's evidence that because of the cross-linking thing, that you need to rapidly release some. If all you're doing is moving the weak bonds around, as you do here, there's no reason for large strain accumulation at all. Something
in the shear bands, yeah. I think we both agree that a lot of that things are happening,
right.
And
right.
In the localized region, the polymer knows that it's entangled. Whether or not they need to break in order to get to that is.
But why is that location picked? There's something going on in that location where it localizes. And it's because, to my conjecture, that it's been stretched to exhaustion between entanglement points.
That's what gives you shear hardening. That's what limits the strain, is the fact it's stretched.
What I'm saying is once you've broken that, it moves so much.
No.
And then it gets.
No, none of the polymer textbooks say that. I mean, that gives you the point at which you stretch between entanglements,
yeah.
Is this engineering strain of 1.6. It's not at 6%. You know, at 6% you've done nothing to change the morphology anywhere at which things knows. It's only in the regions of localized strain which begin to occur at the point where the shear bands are
mm-hmm.
forming that you've stretched things out. So maybe we need to.
We'll talk further about
talk
that
further later.
Right.
But
okay.
Could I ask you one related
sure.
question? If you took off all the stress, for example, that 6%,
from there,
you took off all the stress and you came down. Would there be permanent deformation?
Yes.
So it'd come down.
So you're right below that point, right before you set up there. Yeah. You'd come out somewhere like that. You won't come down linearly, as you can see. It will come down. So there is some kind of structural rearrangement as you go through that part.
Maybe about some more concentric discussion, because in some polymers we could see several making effects. One, second, and so on, and different carriers could be responsible for this.
Yeah, those are in branched polymers,
yes,
and polymers.
And direct experimental study concerning the X-ray diffraction showed, for instance, that for first making, only orientation condition molecular system are responsible. But for last necking, when we have very high hardening, the defects like microshear in the system could be responsible. But for initial necking, as usual, with orientation condition molecular system,
I agree. I just think it's going from the oriented state is when it's beginning to feel the entanglement.
All right, we'll continue that. Let me make the next picture here. This is a recent one, polystyrene. This is a plane strain compression test. And the only reason I show that is band's orientation can be altered by affecting the microscopic stress field. And a plane strain compression test is done by taking, a slab of the material like this, and then pressing down along the line or a little rectangular region, down like that. So you're compressing the material, don't allow strain evolution in the direction parallel to this line, and so it's in a state of plane strain. And then when you do the analysis for what the angle should be where this localization occurs, it turns out to be 45 degrees, and you have these bands localizing at plus minus 45 degrees. Chain memory alloys. I'm only going to show nickel titanium. There is debate about whether other shape memory alloys do the same kind of banding or not. This one is very well characterized. And you do the same thing. You take a material specimen, thin plate-like specimen, and pull on it in tension. And you do that at temperatures in which the material is in its austenitic state, which is a VCC lattice structure. And if you pull on that, it exhibits an initial elastic response. But at some stress level, this austenitic lattice structure is unstable, and the material wants to transform to a martensite, which is a monoclinic structure. And at that point, that transformation occurs. This transformation is associated with an 8% volume change, 8% shear strength, so the material accommodates that transformation by localizing the shear along the band like that. Once a band gets nucleated somewhere, this part is now less stiff than everywhere else. You cannot nucleate any more of these bands, but this band may propagate up and down by recruiting austenite here to transform to martensite here. And that's what happens all along the plateau here. We're simply pulling on the specimen with longer and longer strains, and at constant load, this band moves up and down. There are small peaks here and so on, minor ones, and what that is evidence that these bands, as they move, they get pinned at local defects and they have to be overstressed to release them from there, and then they continue on merrily. If you monitor strain at some point, let's say here, as a function of time, initially that strain is proportional to the stress, and then during this plateau load, there's no increase in strain at that point. It's at a constant strain. All of the pooled accumulated strain occurs by transforming from austenite to martensite as the band propagates, until the entire specimen is stretched. At some time, this band propagates down and envelopes the strain gauge. The strain gauge then measures that 8% strain that I talked about as the accumulated strain from the transformation. And upon reverse, this exhibits a hysteretic behavior. If you unload it, it will transform back to austenite at some level. It comes back almost to zero strain, not quite. So this is the shape memory pseudo-elastic effect of this material. So you can bend this material or pull this material to some level and let go. It will go back to its initial shape, even though it has dissipated some energy in the process. You make eyeglass frames out of this thing because it remembers its shape. You can stretch it out to here and it'll still come back to its initial shape.
That's essentially instantaneous.
It can happen one of two ways. It depends on the transformation temperatures and at what level relative to that you've done this test. It can come down and stop at this point, and then you can do a thermal recovery by heating it up, or you can tailor the temperature such that it comes back all the way to its initial shape upon unloading without any thermal effects there.
Let me just comment. I think that this has been essentially proposed
as the mechanism of deep earthquakes, but it all means Fennell phase change of rocks going down.
Right. Was somebody who gave a talk at the conference?
Green area.
Deep earthquakes, right. Yeah, he mentioned it in the book. Again, this band orientation. Oops. Yeah, there's marked a square there to show it's not 45 degrees, it is in fact the same 54 degrees.
Now, even though this recovers, you wouldn't call this viscoelastic, right?
No.
So there's a question of whether some polymers are viscoelastic or a shape memory in some temperature range.
This is shape memory because the underlying mechanism is very clearly phase transformation. It goes from an austenitic phase to a martensitic phase. In a viscoelastic material, it's a mushy structural change that comes back to whatever it was. So it's phenomenological.
If you call steroids to a pneumatic phase, then you could argue it's similar.
Yeah, people do call some polymers shape memory polymers. Okay. Right? Yeah.
On this comment with a deep earthquake mechanism, I think the difference is that reaction is so sluggish. Mm-hmm. It's incredibly sluggish. So it has to be some other things going on in that transformation.
Why do you say that?
Because it's observed that you can have metastable olivine way beyond the stability field, happily sit there for decades, apparently, or if not longer.
But again, that's the whole problem, like the basalt eclogite and all these things. The question is whether I think the proposal is that it's thermally activated, and once it triggers, then it gets hot, and then
exactly. That's exactly right. There has to be other things going on than just this instantaneous transformation.
How about rate dependence?
In here?
Yeah.
Is not very well characterized. We've done some experiments in the last 6 months to look at what happens to these fronts as they propagate, as this front propagates, what happens to energy dissipation or requirement for energy to do this transformation. And there's some indication that it increases. Very similar to what happens for a crack. Postulate for a crack that the energy required to run the crack increases as a function of the speed with which you do that. So the energy required for generating that phase transformation also turns out to be a function of velocity. Jim Knowles is the model for that in the analysis, and we've done some experiments with a very small range of velocities so far, very small pickup in here.
So that just shows up as a rise in the plateau structure.
Right, right.
And the angular relationships hold here, which looks like it's 45 maybe.
It's not 45, it's
54.
Yeah, it's 54. It's exactly the same thing. Right.
Okay.
It's any kind of strain rate dependence on the transformation for shape memory alloys, for instance. Yeah. There is experimental data by Mark Meyers and also our experimental study. The strain rate dependence will appear starting from propagation strain rate 10 in 3.
Right. And we have some experiments that are just approaching that 10 to the 3. So, again, the mechanisms are very different. You have elastic deformation of the austenite. This transformation introduces that large volume preserving strain that triggers the localization. And the limited extensibility comes from the fact that that strain is only 8%. Then you have to start deforming the Martin site, and it's from the stiffness of the Martin site. I had only a collection of those things, but I wanted to include something on metallic glasses, so I searched the literature in the last couple of days and found there were quite a number of experiments aimed at looking at localization of metallic glasses. It's not as clean. For instance, the bands aren't as cleanly oriented as you saw them in the shape memory alloys or so. But still, the engineering stress versus strain shows an initial linear elastic part. Localization and plateau stress at that point doesn't seem to be propagating bands here, but it's simply nucleating more and more bands at that plateau stress. And here you see these very localized bands that are oriented at 45 degrees now to the load axis. These are very, very short specimens that approximated plane strain conditions.
Does that also in many cases see a stress maximum?
Yes, the stress maximum is sort of a nucleation idea that you have to somehow trigger this band at a point. It's not easy to tie that down as a material property because it depends on how well you prepared your specimen, what the defect distribution is. So you could never approach that nucleation stress with any certainty. You need models to calculate it and say, are your nucleation levels below the model prediction, and then be happy with that. But plateau stress, you could calculate.
But I think in most experiments I have seen that it is stress maximum.
Well, it's because this particular specimen you're showing, I think, is geometrically constrained, so
yeah,
that it won't undergo, it won't have a dramatic
very, very small. Yeah.
It's not like, you know, if you do a uniaxial compression and your aspect ratio is such that a shear band could slice across the system, then at some point it just fails. But this one probably has an aspect ratio that's longer this way than that way, and so the shear bands get limited by running into the loading.
Is it plane strain in this case?
Yeah, this is plane strain, right. Okay. It depends on the amount of elastic energy that you had stored in the rest of the specimen at the point of nucleation, whether that drop from the peak to the plateau is large enough.
Here, besides the STZs, which I guess Mike will talk about or something, there's no mechanism like overstretching of polymers or phase transition to
correct.
Describe what's actually going on here.
So. Right. So maybe Mike will talk about that.
Yeah.
The mechanisms are not clear here at all.
Yeah, in the other cases, there's these two
right.
clean states that
right.
you're transforming matter
right.
between, and that's why they can just, the bands can just grow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's not at all obvious.
And maybe that's why it doesn't grow here.
Yes.
It just has to nucleate.
There is no second magic
right.
phase.
Mm-hmm. Right, the analysis is fairly simple. If you assume that localization occurs along some band oriented at an angle alpha with respect to the loading axis, and that this material is moving at a different in a different direction, and that this vector u dot here is the relative velocity between this block which is moving up and whatever material is moving inside the band, then you could construct the strain rates normal to the band and tangential to the band in terms of the velocity of motion of the cross leg up there, the angle of that band, and the characteristic weight of that band. Then from that you calculate the principal strain rates, impose the yield condition and the flow rule, and you can calculate what the stresses, or the principal stresses ought to be inside that band, and everything is in terms of this angle, sorry.
What yield condition do you use?
This uses von Mises yield condition. All right, then between these two, if you eliminate tau y, you could get an expression for the angle of the band in terms of the stress state. Now if you have uniaxial tension, sigma 2 is 0, you get 19 degrees for the angle of psi, and therefore this band angle alpha is 54.4 degrees, and that's what is observed in the experiments. These are basically the characteristics. There's a characteristic here and one which is symmetric with respect to that. Characteristics for the plane stress problem of rigid, perfectly plastic material. Now, if you make this a plane strain problem and you redo the calculation, you'll come out with that being 45 degrees.
This assumes a pressure-independent
correct.
Yield stress,
right,
which is typically not characteristic of polymers or of amorphous metals.
Right.
And so that introduces a deviation
correct.
From well, this angle, which is also dependent upon whether you're in compressive or tensile.
Correct. Right. And it depends on the friction coefficient, the pressure-dependent coefficient. Right. For the polymers that I showed you, polystyrene and for polycarbonate, this pressure dependence is very weak. And you don't really see a significant change in the bend angle.
Again, I'm confused by that because there's some data on many polymers showing this coefficient alpha to be about 0.1, universal for all the polycarbonate, polystyrene, PMMA, which is enough not to give you a huge change from this, but it should be the same for pretty much all of the...
No, what I meant is that if you do a uniaxial tension experiment, the mean pressure is 1/3 of that stress localization. And it's really small, and the correction that you get for the yield strength is very, very small as well. So you don't have a significant change in this angle as a result of that.
And we should talk off.
Okay.
Short comments. According to my feeling, there is difference in macroscopic mechanism concerning this variant of the instability for metals and for gems. Due to the following reason, because in metals, it's induced by dislocation transitions, in magnetic deformation, by orientation transition magnetic variance, in polymer, due to the orientation effect of molecular system. And for molecular system, there is a large range of relaxation time. For dislocation ensembles and for magnetic variant, it's more or less narrow. It's more or less narrow. Yes.
So you're saying there shouldn't be microscopic similarity? Is that what you're?
I'm not sure that it will be similar for different systems.
Well, I'm showing you here data that shows that the band orientation is identical in these three systems, even though the microscale mechanisms are very different. These are polycrystalline samples of shape memory materials and polycrystalline samples of iron, and so the local effect of where the shear band forms or which variants transform are averaged out when you come to the large scale, and it all looks like an elastic plastic material. So the essential ingredients are then the following, and this is maybe what I'm trying to point out in that summary. There must be a threshold mechanism for triggering this transformation from one phase to another phase, either from austenite to martensite, without arguing with Mark, a pre-entangled to a entangled probe, some transformation mechanism there which allows for large strain accumulation in the plastic. The second ingredient that this occur as a volume-preserving deformation, which is the ingredient that goes into the plasticity theory to give you the right orientation of the band angles. And finally, there must be some limit to the amount of strain accumulated in order for these bands to propagate. Otherwise, localization is the final failure and nothing else happens beyond the localization. How much time?
We're about 25 after, so I mean, we could discuss this.
I'll give you time to discuss this. We've done some numerical simulations that incorporate these things and they're able to reproduce what happens in the polymer very quickly. That's the observed shape, and this only shows a quarter of this due to symmetry. And there is the initiation of the band, and then the propagation of the band captured in the polycarbonate. There are other simulations that do the same thing for the shape memory alloys and for Luders bands.
These are all based on constitutive models
that incorporated
that are continuum sort of.
Correct. Yeah. So they incorporate a threshold, they incorporate a limiting strain, and they assume perfectly volume preserving deformation in between, and then you can do the continuum simulation based on that.
And so do you have to assume a certain width for the initiation of the or?
In these numerical simulations, they're always dependent on the cell size.
So
you can't resolve the smallest cell size, but once you start nucleating and growing, this is okay. So it's for the characteristic or length at which the band initiates is not captured.
You have to put that into the constituent model somehow.
Now, we'll put it in there by the discretization.
Essentially, it's the measure.
Yeah.
You could do it by some non-local or gradient dependent.
Right, a phase field type model. Yes, we'll do that.
It's very important. Okay. really fix the input.
Just in terms of a general, what do you feel about time defense? I mean, you're more or less talking perfect plasticity.
Right.
But no time defense.
Correct.
What's your feeling about time defense?
Time and rate dependence are extremely important for some materials. This particular polycarbonate, when we're looking at room temperature and the glass transition is about 150 Celsius, was not of great significance. If you do the same material and you run the test at 110 degrees Celsius or something, much closer to TG, some of this phenomenological behavior will disappear. In fact, you will not. As you approach the glass transition temperature, you will not shear localize at all. The mobility of these molecules is much larger, and so you're able to pull in uniform tension throughout the entire specimen. There's no localization at all. Through strain rate effects, you could introduce multiple localizations because different materials are strained, different regions are straining at different rates, and you could potentially lock some other region and trigger a shear band. And so in some of the shape memory alloys, we've shown that through strain rate effects, you could have a plethora of these shear localizations, each one propagating independently. So they are important effects, but in specific regimes.
Well, but, you know, in friction,
yeah,
there's a lot of work, a lot of discussion on temperature dependence, even at cold, low temperatures. You think that, and in fracture nucleation and fracture coalescence, there's time delays, and a lot of discussion as to why there are these time delays. Mm-hmm. You think you could look at a scale, say time scales, where there are time effects, like if you did it very fast?
Well, these two are actually coupled effects. You can go to a high temperature and do a very high strain rate experiment, and the tool's going to exhibit a stiff response. And you can handle that with, say, a viscoelastic model to shift between high temperature effects and high strain rate effects.
Well, the viscosity, that's temperature dependent.
Yes. Right. And in fact, it's not a single viscosity, as he pointed out. There's a spectrum of viscosities for these materials, and so you have to incorporate the entire spectrum.
But typically, the slower you go, it would be true that you find these defects would cause nucleation of stuff to happen earlier at lower stress.
Correct.
Much like the fracture, I guess, we saw yesterday.
Mm-hmm. Right. All right, let me stop here and give Mike the rest of the time.
Well, people have other questions.
Yeah, that's fine.
So it seems here there's sort of two parts of the problem. One of them is the nucleation.
Right.
And the other part is, you know, what are the two phases that then determine the steady growth afterwards. And I wonder in shear bands if it's all about nucleation and local hardening as opposed to...
In shear bands in
metalloglass. Right, it's all about nucleation and not growth, but in these other materials, it's all about the nucleation is very difficult to capture, it's all about the growth.
You can capture
that's where everyone
grows
their
cells.
Maybe one final point. So if you want to do small scale simulations and see what you need to throw up to larger scales, these are the essential ingredients that you really need to find out. Small-scale simulations are going to tell you what mechanisms are responsible for the deformation, and therefore what is going to trigger the onset of this. So calculation roughly of a yield stress from that small scale, whether it's based on phase transformation or polymer molecular rearrangements, that threshold stress is a calculation that can come out from there. And then this limit extensibility, how much will that shear transformation allow in terms of strain accumulation? And then this is imposed from the outside, saying that this is a volume-preserving deformation. Then you can do the macroscopic calculations through standard continuum mechanics.
Okay.
so.
If you look at crazing where the volume is not preserved,
right,
you get effectively the same thing. It's just instead of shear localization,
Yeah, but it's a different localization.
It's, right. It's tensile localization.
And it localizes normal to the maximum tensile stress.
But other than that, you just get the whole system deforming into the craze in much the same
way.
But
there are other things in there. There is no real growth of that because there's no mechanism for limiting the strain accumulation.
Yes, there is. Yes, there is. That's why crazes grow to be many microns in size.
There is a competition between the craze growing along its length and new material being pulled into it.
But the new material being pulled in is the same as new material being pulled into the martensitic phase.
No, but once the craze spans the width of the specimen, it's finished. Here, the shear band spans the width of the specimen, it's not. It continues to propagate.
There's nothing a priori that says once it spans the limit, it's finished. In fact, it continues to grow to something which is still fairly big. There's other effects that limit its growth related to crack because you're in mode one in terms of mode two loading. Okay. We can talk about that often.
All right, we'll give Mike some time to.
Okay, I guess we're sort of an hour in, so I'm going to try and abbreviate some parts that I had already presented at the conference anyway. So there's a further presentation of some of the things I'll mention online, and you can feel free to look at it at your leisure later. I'll just mention some of those things and then get onto things that I didn't get a chance to talk about at the conference that I think are maybe very related to some of the things that Robbie was just talking about. So, the questions that I've been asking are a little bit different from some of the cases that Ravi's been showing because I'm primarily interested in the metallic glasses and then the potential to make some kind of conceptual connection to things that might happen in granular materials. So, and as Ravi had mentioned, in those materials, the mechanism for understanding the localization is a lot less well understood from a micromechanical perspective. So what we'd like to know is what are the underlying mechanisms that lead to this sort of localization, and then also how does the onset or degree of localization depend on things like the temperature, the strain rate, how you prepared the system, the history dependence. And then there's this question of what sets the length scale of localization, which we're looking into, but I probably won't talk about that much. So we've been doing, so first I'll talk to you about some of the simulations we've been looking at, and then I'll talk at the end about how we're starting to connect that to the STZ theory. So these are just some illustrations that I did show at the conference before, showing a nano indentation, and just illustrating that in simulation we see a strong dependence of the tendency to localization on the history of the system. So in this case we have a sample that was created by quenching very, very quickly, and samples that were created by quenching more slowly. And the ones that have been allowed to equilibrate for longer amounts of time show much more dramatic localization underneath the indenter. And so we'd like to understand something about why there's this sort of transition from more or less homogeneous deformation underneath the indenter to extremely localized flow.
Just a quick question. Is this a time sequence for a single specimen?
No, these are final this is the strain underneath the indenter at the final strain for three different samples that were produced three different ways. So this was quenched very quickly from the melt. This was quenched much more slowly.
Got it. And are these two-dimensional samples?
These are two-dimensional samples. So yeah, I'll talk a little bit more about what the system is here. Here it's a binary glass, a two-dimensional binary system. I'll also show you some images from some three-dimensional systems.
And these are simulations.
And these are all MD simulations. So the main result that I was talking about at the conference was that what we can do is we can produce samples in these various different ways. So we can quench very quickly, we can quench very slowly, and in that way produce samples that have different potential energies, different degrees of stability. And then we can test those in tension at a variety of different strain rates. And in each of those tests, we can then characterize to what extent did we see localization. We do that by looking at each atom in the sample and asking what is the local strain around that atom. is the local strain around that atom greater than the average strain that you've imposed on the entire sample? And so if we look at something that's deformed very homogeneously, we get something, a factor of about 0.5, because every atom is just as likely to have strained more than the average than less than the average. But if we have something that forms something like a shear band, that same participation ratio goes dramatically down because relatively few atoms have participated in deformation. And so what we've been looking at is the strain. So the first thing we see is that there's this dramatic dependence of the degree of localization on how well stabilized the glass is. So for glasses that were allowed to quench over longer periods of time and that are more energetically stable, we see a much higher degree of localization. But the other change is a change in the strain rate dependence. So here we see, as we're going to lower and lower strain rates, for these glasses we're approaching the limit of 0.5, whereas down here for the glasses that were quenched rather slowly, as we go to lower and lower strain rates, we're approaching the localized limit. So there seems to be some transition with respect to how we prepare the glass from homogeneous deformation in the quasi-static limit to localized deformation in the quasi-static limit.
Going back to the previous transparency, I wonder whether the fact that when you quench, you have the aging of your glass. And so the indentation could be depend how far after the quench you have done the experiment.
Essentially, that's what's happening. I mean, you could think of this in different ways. In this case, we're looking at it as an effect of quench time. But you could also consider doing, I mean, it's not practical to do with molecular simulation, but if you're doing an actual experiment, you could do something similar by taking something that was quickly quenched and then testing it at various times after. And then you would expect this to be in the limit of longer waiting time.
Okay,
right?
So
I think that's an equivalent.
So either changing the quench time, you mean, or better doing the experiment after several time after the quench.
Right. And in some sense, that's what, you know, by characterizing the glasses essentially by the potential energy per atom, so you would expect to be going in this direction if you quenched slower or if you waited longer. But of course, that becomes very, you know, the rate at which you're going down becomes very slow.
Is it basically logarithmic with the rate?
Well, that's not something we've. Is this
the potential energy change?
With the quench rate? I'd have to go back and look at the data. We didn't try and put that. So we've tried to quantify this strain rate dependence of the localization. So we extract the strain rate sensitivity of this deformation participation ratio, and we see a crossover from systems that flow in the limit of low strain rate to systems that localize in the limit of low strain rate. And the other part of this is that we've then tried to go in and look at what structurally has changed between the glasses that are flowing homogeneously and those that are localizing. And to do that, what we've done is gone in and looked at each atom and seen whether it fits into one of a small number of configurations that have a large degree of short-range order. So we can designate each atom as having a high degree of short-range order or a low degree of short-range order. And it turns out that when we do that, we can look for whether the short-range order percolates through the system. And what we find is that if we look at when that short-range order bond percolates through the system, we see a transition out here, not close to where we see the transition from localized flow to homogeneous flow. But if we look at that transition with respect to K-pore percolation, which is saying, do you have a number of neighbors in the cluster that are equal to the dimension plus one? So something you might think was a signature of mechanical stability. Then we see that the percolation transition for the K-pore percolation case corresponds within our error bars to our transition from flow to localization. So that's all stuff I showed before. We've also done similar, we're in the process of doing similar things for a 3D system, so just to show that this isn't an artifact of the two-dimensional glass, this is in an 80-20 Cobb-Anderson glass, and we've done these are, again, different quench times, and you can see as we go to longer and longer quench times, we get more and more dramatic localization. And this happens both in compression and tension. We can also look at these shear band angles then in these cases, and we see that in this case, the system is essentially plane strain. And so you can see the angles are close to 45, though we do see some deviation. So in this case, in tension, something like 47 degrees, in compression, 43 degrees. That would be indicative of something like either a more Coulomb or pressure-dependent von Mises sort of.
So you have periodic boundary conditions, and that's what makes it plane strain?
Yeah, essentially, although we're maintaining zero stress in this direction, we're doing it on average. So in terms of the volume conservation, it's the same as if we're in plane strain, because we're not allowing it to contract in the third dimension.
We could have since Per Bach's paper on time delays, there's been a tremendous number of papers come out like that, it's up to about 1 week on time delays. So everybody's going back and looking at all these kinds of models. Mm-hmm. For example, the ISIN model has a classic phase change, and they're looking at how part of the time delay gain function. So it's nucleation theory.
Uh-huh.
So you have the capability of looking at this as a phase change. You have the capability of looking at the transient development of this in time, a la the fluctuations of an Ising model.
Well, we can definitely look at, we have a time sequence of events that lead up to these localization events. So we can definitely do time analysis. How to map this onto an Ising model is
something. Well, I don't want to map it, it's just that what people are looking at, I mean, there's an indication that in the engineering literature, it's called Weibull model, mm-hmm. but it's a stretch exponential mm-hmm. in physics literature. And all these things appear to be coming out as stretch exponentials.
Uh-huh.
And back in innovation, it's going back 30 years, Gramm's law is a stretch. And so it's a question whether there's a universality in all these models uh-huh. of the stretch exponential. So if you can look
there's an aspect, it's probably easier for me to talk about it in the context of the theories in which we analyze these than in the, than looking at the experiment, the simulations. But I mean, what I can say at this point is that when we attempt to fit these things to the theory, we end up having to put in some temperature dependence for a sort of relaxation in the system, and that ends up being put in with a sort of stretch exponential dependence. As we approach the glass, as we get below the glass.
Just to make sure we're on the same page, you're talking about looking, say, for many, many experiments or simulations, the distribution of times at which something would happen.
Oh.
And that would require, in order to really be able to distinguish between stretched exponential and something else, one would have to have maybe, statistics over 3 decades,
mm-hmm.
Which would mean, in order to resolve the rare events, just huge, huge numbers of statistics. This would be completely impractical with MD. And I've never seen an MD simulation looking at a distribution like that that has enough range to distinguish between a stretched exponential and something else, because you just need incredible statistics. And the stretched exponential has several fit parameters, making it hard to really rule it out. So it would be a tremendous, tremendous challenge computationally.
Right. We've had some success fitting the theory we use to metallic glass rheology data near the glass transition. And there, but to do that, we had to incorporate some sort of stretched exponential-like behavior into the constitutive model. But that's not something that's related to the simulation. Okay, so this I didn't get to show at the conference. So we've also been doing these same sort of simulations in simple shear. And here again, so we have two axes here. This is again, the quench time. So these are the systems that were quenched very quickly, systems that were quenched over very long periods of time. And then we're looking at three different strain rates that span two orders of magnitude. And you can see that we have a situation in which if we are at very high shear rate, it doesn't seem to matter the quench time, we always get homogeneous flow. But if we're at these intermediate shear rates, we seem to get a localized flow for long quench times, but more homogeneous flow for short quench times, and then we appear to get localization again for these lower shear rates. So what we'd like to understand is what combination of history of waiting time, essentially, or quench time, and shear rate produce localization and which produce more homogeneous flow. So I should point out that for some of these are periodic samples, so the top is connected to the bottom.
It looks like there's not a lot of rate dependence in the width of the bands you're seeing at the long quench times. So
yeah, that's true.
So and it's about half your sample.
It's depending on the one, it's about a third of the sample.
A third of the sample, yeah.
So you're showing us what happens over 100% strain. Is there sort of substructure within that 100% strain, or is it deforming more or less?
Yeah, definitely. If we look at the beginning, we see sort of shorter, more narrow events. And then, so if you time resolve it much more finely, you may see sort of shorter events that are more narrow. But then this is sort of the cumulative strain over long amounts of time.
Deform homogeneously at any strain level?
Does it deform? You mean if we were to go out to infinite?
No, this particular condition.
It's smaller.
If we were to go to very high.
At 1%. This is at a macroscopic shear.
Oh, yeah. So initially, maybe I have a slide here that may. Right, okay. So this is strain rate versus position at various shear strains. And so initially, from 0 to 4% shear, it's deforming essentially homogeneously, and then it starts to.
So for higher shear rates, then maybe at 1,000% strain, it's still localized.
We have a limit to the amount of strain we can go to, but yeah, it seems though that if we believe that what's happening here is a change in the local short range order, we can look at the degree of local short-range order, and if the local short-range order that ends up being developed in the sample, across the entire sample, is one that we would associate with flow, then it would seem to be potentially, it would seem unusual that it would then go to a state where it would seize up as you're driving it, as you're continuing.
So you're saying that there is no order like that in this force to 4% strain?
So like, for example, here, this is one that does localize. We start out with a relatively high degree of short range order, and then inside the shear band, the short range order dips down. So if what we see is in the homogeneous ones that the short range order ends up going down across the whole system, then we've never seen it. I'm not sure if it's impossible that it's gone back up in some region and then seized up, which is sort of what we'd have to expect would happen if it were to localize at a later time under constant driving.
If your particle interactions short range or long range?
Short range.
Nearest neighbor?
No, second nearest neighbor approximately. Okay, so how have we been thinking about this? So we've been trying to think about this in terms of this STZ model that others have mentioned. And so I'm going to try and, without describing a lot of the details of the STZ model, talk about this recent introduction of disorder temperature that Jim Langer had worked on for maybe about the past year, and what that would say about this sort of behavior that we're seeing in simulation. So in very generic terms, when you write down the plastic strain rate in the context of the STZ model with this disorder temperature, you end up with that, depending on some function of the stress and some internal variables that describe the local anisotropy in the material, which I'm just going to describe as this rate over here. And then there's a prefactor that depends on this disorder temperature, chi. And so clearly the strain rate is very sensitive to the disorder temperature. As the disorder temperature goes down, you'd expect the strain rate also to drop dramatically. The history dependence in the model is simply dependent on, ends up in this particular model to be dependent just on stress and that same variable. So, and that's important just in so far as we can say that in steady state, when this is zero, this internal parameter becomes slave to the stress. So if you know the stress, you can find the value of this internal variable in terms of the stress. So I won't really refer to that again, because I'm going to be considering steady states. So the important thing becomes, how does this disorder temperature change with time? What's happening to the structural degrees of freedom in the glass as it's being sheared? And so the theory is that there's some rate at which that disorder temperature is approaching some infinite value, some high value, and that rate is related to the amount of dissipation that's going on during the shear flow. So the shear itself is pushing you to high disorder temperature. It's trying to make your system configurationally disordered. But then there's also a rate at which temperature is trying to drive your configurational degrees of freedom to be in equilibrium with the heat bath. And so there's a rate at which temperature is driving things to some low value of the disorder temperature. And so these two things are competing. And so if you were to write this chi versus s, what the steady states of chi at different stresses are, what you find in this model is that at high temperature, they're simply single valued. So you would expect at high temperature for any given s, there's a unique value of chi you get to, depending on the and a particular strain rate. Whereas as you go to lower and lower temperatures, you can get some regions in which the value of chi, the value of the disorder temperature, is double valued in the stress, which would imply that as you get to particular stresses, you have the potential that you have two steady states, one of which is flowing and one of which is creeping.
So if we think though about metallic glasses, then what we saw earlier is that, so this would be a coexistence between two states, but instead of the cases of polymers,
right,
or iron, the states would not be strained states with fixed maximum strains.
No.
They would be states with zero and finite strain rate, right?
Well, not necessarily zero. In this case, very, very low strain rate.
But then,
finite. But two finite strain rates, one of which, one is very, very low and one is, you know, measurable.
Right. And so if you've got localization like that, you'd expect to keep on seeing the strain on that localized state. What we saw for metallic glasses was typically that you get more and more of these shear bands developing as opposed to continued steady flow on the ones that have been established.
I think that depends a lot on the details of the experiment. So for example, in the experiment that Ravi Chandar was showing the detail from, you're in a state where you're in a geometry where and correct me if I'm wrong, Ravi, but so you nucleate some shear band at 45 degrees, and then
you move the driving force in this particular geometry. The shear band locally removes the driving force, which is why it goes.
Right.
So
then it's sort of relieved near there. Whereas if you start with a geometry that's more like this, you end up getting a shear band like this, and then it continues to slip along that shear band until you get fractured along that shear band. So,
can you define phase equilibrium's nodal in that picture?
So that's what I was going to show next. So, what would you then expect? So, I don't know if this is exactly the same as phase equilibrium or spinodals, but at least, so what you would then expect would be at low stress, you would have a well-defined value of the disorder temperature, and you'd get something like stable creep. At high stress, you'd have this region up here where you have some value of the stress that's related to a high value of the disorder temperature and get stable flow. But then in these in-between regions, yeah, you get essentially something like, I guess this would be essentially the spinodal region in some generalized sense. So here, all these states are unstable. So you'd expect any attempt to drive the system at a strain rate typical of these disorder temperatures would result in instability into shear bands, because none of these are stable states. And then you have these other two regions where you have metastable creep or metastable flow, where you could potentially have stable creep, but you then also have the potential to nucleate a shear band within that region. And so what this potentially indicates is that if we believe in those simulations I was showing before, that we're moving with strain rate down from a strain rate at which we get homogeneous flow at all initial conditions to homogeneous flow depending on the initial condition, that could correspond to a motion from stresses or strain rates typical of this region to stresses typical of this region, where you might expect the final state of the system to just depend sensitively on the initial condition.
Would you expect by this phase spinodal argument that if you were at a strain rate somewhere in the middle, that you'd move from the fraction of your volume that was in the two states would change as a function of the driving rate, so that the width of the band would not so be?
So you're saying if I change my stress, would I expect necessarily my strain rate would, my band would widen?
Yes.
Would we expect that the strain rate in the band would drop, which is apparently what we're seeing. We're seeing the strain rate in the band drop. And it's not clear at this point that it necessarily, I mean, one argument you could make is that, well, perhaps it selects this point over here and you have a typical stress that you want to be at and a typical strain rate in the band, which would indicate that then the band would have to be at this particular strain rate, and as you played with the strain rate, the band would have to widen and narrow. Is this what you're sort of suggesting? But I don't think there's any a priori reason why you would expect that it has to be at this particular strain rate. It can actually
typically
move over this range.
In such phase transitions, you'd find the line in between those and partition equal areas to those things, find the Maxwell construction.
I'm thinking of whether there's a Maxwell construction or whether there's other hidden variables in the problem that make it more complicated.
Well, I'm not sure if I get the drift just though that, I mean, at some point, well, we're controlling the strain rate in these particular simulations. So we haven't really told it where it has to sit in terms of the stress. So if I knew the stress, I could figure out what.
But the idea is that the system would figure out
how to partition
between, right.
Using what?
Well, using whatever kinetics there is.
Using the
minimization of the free energy, which of course we don't have. But, but if there is a spinodal analogy,
then
there is some generalized free energy, mm-hmm. which would allow you to do the Maxwell construction.
So we have the dynamics, so we can follow the dynamics for a given system simulated forward and figure out given the model what it does, but I don't know yet what plays the role of the free energy that we can figure out that partition a priori without going through the dynamics.
Oh yeah, I mean, you're using equilibrium thermodynamic points of view in the other case, and it'd be very nice if you do the same here. Infinitely slowly have a macro construction,
right.
You're in business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is relatively, you know, what we're working on this month. So I'm really happy to talk to people about it as we continue.
Can I just clarify something? M is the amount of heuristic zones?
M is the, in the language of the model, it's the ratio sort of a plus zones to minus zones. So it's essentially the built up anisotropy in the distribution of zones in the material.
OK, so who does this Maxwell if we had plot with M on it.
You think if we...
But how the disorder, how different the disorder, because how is it related to, M? Or?
The disorder, well, this is essentially a measure of the disorder, chi. So, and chi ends up not being related to M, it ends up being related to the number of defects, not the ratios between the populations.
Okay, so it's more the amount of defects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's the knowledge, the wetness of the steam.
But I'm sorry.
I used to teach this stuff, right? But basically, the amount of water. You know, if you go from one end to nucleation vapor.
How much water you've actually put into the? Yeah. So essentially, it's sort of how much of the material have you turned into this sort of low short range order defective state? Yeah.
Is there any confinement pressure on
that? In this case. No, not. I mean, we try and keep it around zero pressure. So,
right.
But they're done at constant volume. So we relax the system to zero pressure and then we shear. So there may be some finite pressure on the system that we can monitor during the simulation. But yeah,
because
pressure may be important.
Because you know, this is mm-hmm. obviously slightly different, but in dynamic material simulations, which are not perfect, but they show that there is a great dependence of localization on normal confinement.
Yeah, it may be in these systems we've seen much less dependence on normal confinement. We've done this similar things on a smaller system in 3D, where we've done it both at constant volume under very high pressure and at close to zero pressure. And I mean, there are some quantitative shifts that happen, but we still see sort of similar stress strain behavior, similar change in the short range order with flow. Certainly there are effects of the pressure on the point of yield, which you can see from the change in the shear band angles. But I'm not sure that the effect is as dramatic in these atomic cohesive systems as it is in the granular systems.
Just to answer Mark's question about Maxwell construction, in the cases where the order parameter is well identified, like in worm-like micelles, so there is a theory that couples the order parameter to the flow, but Peter Holmsted, for example, has done that, and that gives you precise Maxwell construction. But here, the actual question is, what is the order parameter? I mean, if we knew that, it would be easy to just take Holmsted's theory.
But I guess this would argue that chi is somehow.
Yeah, but we don't know how to measure it or how to get it from the configuration. So.
Well, but it's in the theory. It's in the constitutive model. It's
a parameter in the constitutive model. Yeah. I mean, whether we can.
It's a different thing about the simulations.
Yeah. I mean, we're hoping to make a connection between chi and the degree of short range order in the simulations, but that's sort of tenuous at this point. But within the constitutive theory.
But was chi related to those little dark ones you showed previously in a couple of graphs?
Conceptually, chi is supposed to be related to the fraction of atoms that don't have short range order.
Yeah,
so
in that sense, it's well defined as an Ising model.
So I mean, if we can build that bridge, then. So that's what we're in the process of trying to do.
I think it was a very interesting question, how to identify the structure of order parameters. Because according to my feeling, one of the challenges of A could be related to dynamic experiment with characteristic time and scale, who could be related to characteristic nonlinearity in the transition material, not in quantitative case.
Well, we're really like over into lunchtime now.
Break for lunch and continue.